And welcome back to the Richard Rant Show. For the second half of my show today, we're going to have a very special guest dialing in. His name is Max, and he is indeed Max in many ways. And he is a law student at Georgetown University who's done work in criminal justice and democracy protection through the Senate Judiciary Committee and other institutions. He's been a fighter for those who are less privileged, for the working class. He was a teacher in inner city schools. He's been a Democratic activist throughout this election, helping to elect Joe Biden and get Donald the Chump out of office, that criminal, that dangerous, unhinged narcissist in charge there and no longer in charge. Thank goodness for that. Oh my gosh. So Max will be calling in, and he will be calling in 4 minutes. So, oh, perhaps this is him now. So I believe it is. Hello there, Max.
Hey, Rich. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks. How are you?
Not too bad. Are we going to mention that we're related?
We can mention. No, we can mention that. You can mention it. I'm proud. Proud to be related to you, my friend. Yeah.
Likewise.
My cousin. Yeah, so Max is my cousin, you know, in full revealing any potential conflicts of interest here.
All good.
Yeah. Excellent. And, you know, I follow your posts on Facebook. They've been great throughout the democratic process of our election, which went about really as well as we could have perhaps expected in this situation of COVID and destruction of the previous Trumpian presidency. So thank you for that.
Yeah, no, appreciate you having me on. It's overdue. We've always been very politically tuned in, and you know, I like that we're interacting more. I appreciate your perspective.
Likewise.
And happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot. Now, we did differ in the primary because I was a big Bernie supporter, and I still am a huge Bernie supporter. And you didn't think that Bernie would be a good candidate to defeat Trump at the time. And, well, I have to say that, you know, as it turned out, Joe Biden won, so we can't say that he was a bad candidate. So maybe we're right, but we just don't know.
From the beginning, I was, you know, a lot of people describe this past election with the word existential, right? That was just kind of the word that was thrown around a lot. And I think for me, you know, existential carries certain implications in terms of kind of risk aversion and just making sure you stack the deck in your favor as much as possible. And yeah, I analyzed all the candidates pretty coldly and analytically and what their path was and what the data showed. And basically my conclusion was Biden had the most clear path to victory. And again, if you're talking about existential, that brings risk aversion.
I thought
this is the best bet. Mm-hmm. It kind of meets certain elements of the historical moment. And though it was very a head-driven decision rather than a heart-driven decision in some ways, mm-hmm. I, for instance, like peed a lot, but I didn't see that path for him. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was interesting, that kind of evolution over time. And, you know, the hypotheticals are always going to be interesting. We just mm-hmm. can't know.
Yeah.
But even for me, I don't know that I expected Biden to get, you know, the highest popular vote margin since FDR of a challenger, like,
beautiful,
you know, 7 million vote differential. even at my most optimistic, I don't think I fully envisioned how this turned out. Though the flip side is also there's still a lot of people voting for Trump, and part of going to this election just kind of hoped
Well,
it'd be, you know, 70-30, 80-20.
Sure.
That's not the country we live in, unfortunately. And these margins always move in a fairly limited fashion, 51, 47, 48. That's just the country we live in. But in spite of that, it was a very dominant victory, and I was happy with it.
Yes, it certainly was. Because while the Democrats did, in fact, manage to get more voters out than ever before, So did the Republicans.
You know, interestingly, I've seen some numbers on that, which have surprised me. I don't want you to quote me offhand because I'm not 100% sure, but I've seen numbers that, I could be wrong, but that Trump's margins in a lot of swing states were actually very similar to 2016, and if you talk about like percentage of the vote, like Mitt Romney actually got a higher percentage of the vote than Trump, right? Like Mitt Romney, unironically, got 47%, and Trump is more at like 46. So that's been one aspect of how the election's covered that I don't totally understand or get this like idea that, you know, Trump really proved himself and so on. Like he basically seemed to do largely the same as 16, and frankly, another interesting dynamic is that Biden outperformed the Democratic Party and the Republican Party outperformed Trump. It's a very interesting dynamic.
Yes. Well,
I don't totally know how to make sense of it. Some like working theories, but they basically had the inverse problem.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you my theory on that, which is also shared by my favorite commentators from the Democrat side over at Pod Save America, which is that many of the people who voted for Biden over Trump did so because he wasn't Trump, because Trump was so odious, was so obviously criminal and as well as incompetent and corrupt, that even people who liked Republicans didn't like Trump. And so they voted against him. But when it came to the down ballot races, they felt their other Republicans were decent people still.
Yeah.
And so they voted for them. And that may just explain why Biden's margin was bigger than the Democratic margin, because the other Democrats weren't running directly against the evil Trump, you know.
That's probably the best explanation that's possible. Because I haven't looked at it too closely, but like the Georgia data is like fascinating, right? Because part of the narrative has been that basically, you know, Stacey Abrams came and saved the day, and trust me, I'm a huge Stacey Abrams fan.
Oh, huge! Fantastic. Yeah, I think she brought us, you know, for a large extent, she brought us Georgia. I mean, it was a combination of factors, but go ahead.
Well, now you're going to be mad at me because that was the narrative, and I wanted to believe that narrative because I'm a huge fan of hers. But again, the data does paint this more complicated picture, and it kind of paints the picture you're describing that, yes, there was a lot more voter registrations, which is huge. There's a lot of people who didn't vote in 16, who did vote in 20. But it does seem like a huge part of the shift in Georgia, and again, I should be fresher on my numbers. There was a good New York Times report on this. But a lot of the shift was basically the suburbs. Yes, there was like record turnout in certain Democratic stronghold cities, and that made a difference.
Yeah.
But really, like a big story of the shift in this election was the suburbs, and that there really, like, genuinely were people who voted for Biden and voted for some Republicans. It just goes, to me, it kind of shows that, the Democratic demography game is just very complicated. And Ezra Klein has talked about how the demographics of the parties are creating completely different incentives because Republican demographics, you know, are basically rewarded by the Electoral College. You know, Democrats have to win by like 5%, 4% in the popular vote to even have it translate to the Electoral College. And because Republicans can kind of keep winning on this insular, demographically homogenous base, they keep doing so, and they don't really have an incentive to go beyond it, and that the Democratic Party has essentially the exact opposite problem, that it has a ridiculously diverse demographic and a really, really big tent that has so many moving pieces and kind of doesn't have a choice but to try to really persuade people. And you can see how that it affects the behavior of the parties, right? Like, Democrats have to constantly do this balancing act where you don't want to lose too many people here, but you don't want to gain people here. And Republicans just kind of don't. And I think the one cautionary thing I think I sometimes see in the Democratic Party is it seems like there's this yearning to kind of mimic the tactics of the Republicans, right? Like this idea of, well, they have...
You mean like voter suppression?
Drag everything to the right. Why can't we just do that on the left and have, you know, a left version of the Tea Party? And it's a tempting dynamic, but it just... You know, the incentives of the parties are just completely different. Like, we literally can't operate the way they do and be politically successful based on the Electoral College and the demographics. And it's a challenging dynamic. It makes our job, frankly, harder than theirs a lot of the time.
In a way. And the Democratic Party certainly is not going to resort to the voter suppression that the Republican Party generally depends on. And the discrimination and against, you know, non-residents and, you know, in the census, for instance. And, you know, Democrats are certainly not going to do that. But that's also immoral. And it's anti-democratic.
Asymmetric warfare problem, right?
Yeah.
They engage in tactics that are bad for democracy but can get you some short-term victories. And we, I think, you know, try to play the high road, which, you know, is valuable in of itself, but there is a problem when one side, you know, abides by norms and the other doesn't. It's a really challenging problem. And I'm someone who's pretty hawkish on this stuff and think that, you know, too often Democrats kind of bring a knife to a gunfight.
And they
have to.
Totally.
Hold people accountable, especially what's going on with the pardon power right now. You have to play hardball, or you are opening up Medusa's box for a parade of horribles that a more competent and vicious right-wing populist will take advantage of.
Yeah,
in an even worse fashion.
Yeah,
that's a real balancing act. Is how Biden has to navigate kind of authoritarian proofing the American government while also delivering in the midst of a crisis, and recognizing he only has so much political capital, and like most people don't give a shit about politics and are just like, why are you prosecuting Trump? Why are you holding him accountable? I can barely pay the rent, like focus on things that matter.
Yeah.
That is going to be a very challenging balance. And I really hope he finds the right combination.
It doesn't have to be him. It can be the District of New York. It can be the state of New York. So he doesn't have to touch Trump's, prosecutions. He's got prosecutions going on in numerous state and local jurisdictions, as well as private civil suits. So Biden doesn't have to touch any of that. He just has to not pardon him. And anyway, he can't pardon him for non-federal crimes. So it's going to be out of his hands.
Yeah, that's a good point. It can be out of his hands because there's other things going on. I think there will be two questions that can connect to him. One, what level of congressional oversight do you want of all the problems that happen, right? Some of that stuff really does have to happen. Like the criminal shit we've done to immigrant children, whatever.
Yeah.
That has to be investigated.
For
you
sure.
You have to put in systems to prevent that from ever happening again, and you have to hold accountable people.
You got to hold them accountable.
So there is a congressional oversight element, and that's also valuable because pardons do not insulate you from congressional oversight. which is going to be a useful Good. Leverage point. And the other question will be whether, you know, his Justice Department does pursue charges for obstruction of justice.
Yeah.
For instance, and that's a hard call.
That's a tough call.
I won't describe that as an easy call. It is a hard call.
That can be a tough call
right now, but you know,
but
that's a possibility.
But if it's a congressional inquiry, it can be done without the Department of Justice.
Yes.
Initially. Exactly. It can be initiated, and then they can bring the Department of Justice in, perhaps. I believe congressional inquiries can request that the FBI provide certain information. So,
the distinction that is hugely valuable, and if your listeners are into this stuff, is a huge shift, is congressional oversight has been basically completely kneecapped in the Trump administration. And the reason is when Congress issues subpoenas, and I won't get too into the weeds, there's basically three enforcement mechanisms. They can give a citation to the Department of Justice, they can go to a court, or they can use inherent contempt. Mm-hmm. The first option has traditionally been what's used. You know, so if you subpoena someone, Congress subpoena someone, and they don't answer, you go to DOJ and you say, hey, enforce this subpoena. The problem was when the House of Representatives, which was controlled by Democrats,
yeah,
you know, asked Bill Barr's Justice Department
forget
to subpoena, he left with them, and
yeah,
that enforce mechanism didn't exist.
Right.
The courts take too long to enforce the subpoena.
Right.
Like they can, but it will take years, and then the whole point is moot.
Sure.
And inherent contempt is a really old power of Congress's ability to arrest people, hasn't been used in almost a century. I think uh-huh. there's ways to bring it back through a fine mechanism, but the point mm-hmm. is, it's not cool. super practical. So the huge difference will be if the Democratic House now tries to investigate stuff, such as, you know, what they've done to immigrant children,
yeah.
the Biden Justice Department can enforce that subpoena. And that is a complete game changer.
Yes.
So that really does matter.
But now that Justice Department is not going to enforce any subpoenas until after January 20th, I would guess.
Yeah. No, all this stuff is only when he's officially inaugurated. Yeah.
Right. And later in January, we're going to have those all-important Georgia runoff elections for two senators, which will tell us whether the Democrats actually wind up with control of both houses and the presidency. And of course, not control of the Supreme Court. And
yeah.
if the Democrats win the Senate, we could kick out McConnell and say goodbye to that so-and-so, to that obstructionist who doesn't care about anything except for bringing in unqualified and ultra-right-wing judges into the system.
Yeah.
That's the only thing he's done. That's been his goal. That and probably to make money for himself, like most of them.
Yeah, McConnell is terrible, and he's really going to go down as one of the villains of this chapter because he knows what he's doing. That's what makes him
Oh, famous. Yeah, he does.
He is very cunning. Mm-hmm. So interestingly, one point I will mention, it's just a point of nuance, is it's very rare that you get a 50-50 Senate, and to be totally honest with you, and I've looked a little bit into this, it isn't a percent clear what happens in terms of like who's majority leader and who isn't. Like obviously Kamala Harris would be the tiebreaker for the purposes of votes,
mm-hmm.
but in terms of the operation of the Senate, when you have a 50-50 Senate, I actually don't think there's clear precedence. And I think what has happened in the past, and again, I could be wrong in this, don't quote me, is that the parties actually have to work out like a contractual power relationship.
Uh-huh.
We're kind of like, hey, you'll be majority leader, but we get this, blah, blah, blah.
Uh-huh.
So I don't really know how that would shake out.
Interesting.
And it's obviously what we need to go for. But there's just so many, there's so many aspects of our politics where we're in uncharted territory. And frankly, a 50-50 Senate is also uncharted territory
now,
in some ways for how that will work in practice. And I don't have
yeah,
the answers. But
that's very interesting. I didn't know that. If the Democrats win both Georgia seats, the Democrats will have a straight-up majority on the Senate, wouldn't they? That's my understanding.
Well, it would be 50-50, and when a vote is 50-50, the vice president votes and is the tiebreaker. So they have a functional majority, but they don't have a clerical majority. And I think when you have a 50-50 Senate, like I said, I could be wrong, I'll double check.
Mm-hmm.
The Senate has to like work out a power relationship because
that's
like
interesting.
The fact that Kamala is a Democrat and she's VP doesn't just mean, oh, well, Chuck Schumer's majority leader.
Well, illegal. It means if they put it to a vote that the Democrats are going to win, right?
Yeah, but the problem is the majority leader has so much power in terms of controlling the floor, what legislation gets brought up, what gets a markup, and unfortunately, I think having a 50-50 split is not dispositive in making the Democrats, making Chuck Schumer majority leader. Again, I'd have to check. I think parties have historically worked out some kind of agreement.
Well, it wouldn't be McConnell, that's for sure, because if they put it to a vote, Democrats win.
Yeah, that's true.
So,
it wouldn't be McConnell.
No.
The point is, we don't exactly know how that works out in practice, but it is what we have to fight for because,
yes.
My God, the difference between let's call it a Democratic Senate and not is just
enormous.
It's enormous. Unfortunately,
yeah.
Basically what it means is if we get both, and it's possible, it's possible. You know, our ability to work on COVID relief and all this stuff is just vastly improved. And unfortunately, if we don't, then, you know, Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, and Lisa Murkowski are just way more powerful than they should be. And it's kind of their Senate.
Right.
Which, like, isn't the worst thing, but it's not good.
Well, no. McConnell continuing to be in charge is pretty much the worst thing.
I have to
say there's nothing worse than that. There has been nothing worse than that. He's obstructed absolutely everything. He's stolen Supreme Court judges and made sure to pass other judges while passing nothing to alleviate the pain and the suffering of the American population during this time. He's been nothing but negativity and a horrendous, and like you said, will go down in history as one of the most divisive and anti-democratic majority leaders in history.
Yeah, no, 100%. We'll see. I mean, there's some like kind of interesting developments on the Senate side. You know, there does seem to be some degree of like the Republican Party eating its tail. Like you're seeing like some billboards saying like, mm-hmm. Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue didn't come through for Trump, so write in Trump, and some degree of like they're eating their own. And there's the insider trading stuff.
Yeah.
And that we have like
decent
candidates, and a really good organization. So I'm hoping there's a way to pull it off. I think there's a shot.
Yeah, I think there's a shot, and we really need it. And we did come through with the Biden win and the Trump loss when we really needed it. And we may come through with this as well. And the fact that Trump has backed off of his support of the governor of Georgia, Kemp, in light of the fact that Kemp is finally bowing to taking some of the minimum measures to protect against the coronavirus.
Yeah.
And because of that, Trump now says that he's ashamed to have backed him. And that may, you know, from the Democratic perspective, hey, if that puts a little damper on some of those Republican voters coming out to the polls to vote for those senators, then, hey, thanks, Trump. You know, that's, you know, we can thank him for, in some ways, we can thank him for just being so inept and incompetent on top of all his other terrible flaws. Because that has really enabled us to come in and get rid of him. I mean, can you imagine? Even he got nailed with the coronavirus. He could have taken steps, obviously, like other countries did, to minimize the damage, but he didn't. He did the reverse. Got nailed by the coronavirus, the worst depression since the Great Depression. Millions out of work. People suffering. Black Lives Matter coming up. And yet, what? He still got 70 million votes?
Yeah.
You know? So that's how serious it is for the Democrats. They, you know, this has been unparalleled disaster, and yet he still, I mean, had a chance of pulling it off. How can that even be? So.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a few things. I mean, one is just the fact that the Electoral College is insane. I mean, think about the fact that Biden won by 7 million.
Yeah.
And Trump lost by 3 million in 2016.
Right.
And he got the exact same number of the Electoral College. That's a 10 million gap. Like, that's insane.
That's insane.
That's a huge part of the problem. And yeah, we're just really, really, really tribal and polarized. And I think there's been this expectation that people would move from Trump or just not vote. And unfortunately, it's just not, it's not where we are. And yeah, it's a tough one. I think a lot of people are kind of mentally reconciling, because I think with 2016, in the most generous interpretation, you could say people didn't know what they would get. They thought he was a businessman, whatever.
Yeah, right. That's pretty generous, man.
Yeah, no, it's extremely generous. But none of that exists for 2020. And like you said, we are in such a rough place. But yeah, it's pretty hard to parse apart. I think a lot of it is just negative partisanship. It's just hatred of the other side.
It's
keeping people loyal. And frankly, you know, a lot of people have been pointing out, like, oh my God, he did so well in spreading coronavirus. Like, if you look at most international leaders, most of them got much more popular through this crisis. Like, it's not guaranteed that coronavirus was going
to
be that Trump went down the dumps. Like, most of the time, if you're president and you look like you're in charge and you're doing, like, a halfway decent
job,
and you look stoic, like, your popularity is going to go up.
Yeah.
Most leaders, Trudeau, all these guys, they're very popular right now.
Right.
The only thing I'd push back on is the idea that, like, of course, you know, how did you do so well instead of coronavirus? Like, a crisis can be a great opportunity for a president.
It can be.
He just did a terrible
job. Exactly. He was so short-sighted and incompetent, which is his way, that he made it much, much, much worse than it needed to be. And that's why he got less popular, whereas the others, maybe, you know, they got in late, but eventually they took the best steps, the recommended, well-known best practices to fight a pandemic that is airborne like this. It's well-known. It's not new. It's not rocket science. And they listen to the medical experts and the public health experts, and they put it into action. And they had a consistent message throughout the government, and that's something Trump couldn't do.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's why he failed on that, and he failed so miserably. But he did fail miserably, unlike those others that actually gained some popularity, because they did at least some minimum, whereas Trump actively worked against it. He did things that actively made more people sick and die.
Yeah, I think the thing that I'm, like, trying to mentally grapple with a little bit is, you know, it does seem like I took a class on information warfare this semester and have gotten a little obsessed with it, because it does seem to be kind of the X factor in explaining the moment that we're in
terms totally
of asymmetric warfare, disinformation, and so on. And that has been one of the more unnerving pieces of all this to me, is just how far the goalposts have moved.
Yeah.
Like, how numb as a society we've become to things we shouldn't accept. And, you know, that's just a basic example yesterday, but, like, you know, again, in this class, we've had to, like, read from the best authors and study them. And, like, Chris Krebs in, like, the cybersecurity world is a rock star. Right? Like, if you watch his panel discussions, he really knows what he's doing. You know, he did a very strong job in 2020 of coordinating with state and local governments, and he's a lifelong Republican, but, like, he did a good job. Like, he did what he was supposed to do.
You've got 30 seconds.
Yeah. And, you know, he got fired. And then now there's, like, public death threats from Trump's lawyer against him. And, you know, years ago, you know, Obama wore a tan suit and people freaked out. And now, like, you get public death threats against government officials and people don't have that. That's not a healthy place to be.
No, it isn't. Well, Max, thank you for being on. I'm going to have to end the show. coming up here, and I hope I have you on again for your excellent commentary. And it's been a pleasure having this conversation, and I look forward to many others.
Yes, no, I would love to keep the conversation and appreciate the time, and always good talking with you, Rich.
Right on. Thanks, Max. Cue the music.
All right, here we go.